This is David Rovics, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Radio Show, which can be heard on community radio at 3CR in Melbourne and Skid Row in Sydney. My name is Vivian Langford, and salut Babette. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and pay tribute to the decades-long legacy of Aboriginal fights for land rights and against the destructive mining projects that are fueling climate change. In particular, we acknowledge the Wangan and Jagalingu cultural custodians and their ongoing opposition to coal mining on their lands in central Queensland, and to the Gomeroi traditional custodians' continuing opposition to coal and gas on their land in New South Wales. It is vital at this late stage in history that we all learn to care for country. It will always be Aboriginal land, and now is our time to all stand up for and protect it.
The Santa Marta Conference in Colombia was a glittering occasion. Not glittering in the sense of sequins and jewels, but glittering with fresh faces and confident voices. This was a fresh start, a rebellion in the midst of an oil crisis, yet again holding the whole world to ransom and frightening us with what could happen next. I watched many sessions of Santa Marta on YouTube, and I was enchanted by Colombian leaders, especially like Yuvelis Morales, Irene Vélez Torres, and President Gustavo Petro. With the Netherlands as co-host, they were gathering a coalition of doers and challenging the blockers who have turned the United Nations climate conferences into a game of delay. Susana Mohammed, the former Environment Minister of Colombia, said this to a young man from Fridays for Future.
We are in Santa Marta, Colombia, because the government of Colombia and the Netherlands decided to host a conference to finally talk about what for 30 years they haven't been talking about. How do we phase out the fossil fuels? Can you imagine 30 years and they were not even able to recognize that fossil fuels is the cause of climate change? I mean, you were not even born and you already understand it. And this is like crazy. But now, for the first time, diplomatically, because I know young people, scientists, academics, the activists have been talking about it, but diplomatically, these 50 countries are sitting here and are saying, okay, how are we going to phase out fossil fuels? That's why this is historic and very important.
Thank you so much. And what would your message be to countries like the U.S. that aren't here today and are instead continuing to build out new fossil fuel projects?
Well, you know what? We are tired with the countries that are blocking this. And they have been trying to ignore the obvious. Why? Because they want to hold on their economic power and economic structures. And those economic structures really oppress the Global South. And so the Global South saying no more. We have the biodiversity, we have the minerals, we have the transition, we can do it. But we want to do it peacefully, not through military means, not through impositions, peacefully through dialogue. And so rather than thinking about those, putting our energy that don't want to do it, that want to oppose, that are doing military actions to oppose the change, we are concentrated on how can we build momentum and energy with the ones that are willing. So actually to this conference, they were only, it was by invitation, and only countries that want to phase out or see, have declared that transition away from fossil fuel is critical are here. And we are putting all our energy to build the alternatives, to start mobilizing rather than waiting and get blocked by those that want to hold on their power, even at the cost of humanity.
Our two guests tonight were at Santa Marta. Louise Morris from the Australia Institute is an award-winning advocate, and I'm going to ask her about removing subsidies and other systemic changes we need. And from the Stockholm Environment Institute, we have Emily Gosch, who will tell us about roadmaps and alternative futures. The song today is from Ali Primera called Los que mueren por la vida, which means those who die for life. It's a famous rallying sort of song, and I hope you love it as much as I do.
Canta, canta, compañero, que tu voz sea disparo, que con las manos del pueblo no habrá canto desarmado. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero. Canta, canta, compañero, que no calle tu canción. Si te falta bastimento, tienes ese corazón que tiene latir de bombo, color de vino ancestral. Viene tu cueca de lucha cabalgando un viento austral. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Louise Morris from the Australia Institute is with us now. She went to the Santa Marta conference and witnessed the exuberant dialogues there. I wish I was there. That sounded like a fantastic conference full of fresh faces. She is a climate advocate, and I'd like to know from her, what are the top ideas to enable the transition away from fossil fuels? So welcome to the Climate Action Radio Show, Louise. I'd like to start on the contrast you felt between Santa Marta, where Australia was hardly represented, and coming home to a gas debate in Canberra.
Yeah, thanks, Vivian, and thanks for having me on. It was quite the privilege to be able to attend in person the first ever conference convened by international governments dedicated to a transition away from fossil fuel. And it was deliberately set up as a countenance to the UN COP process. So its genesis was at the Belém COP in Brazil, which, you know, it's been going for 30 years, and we're still at a point where petrostates like Saudi Arabia can veto oil, gas and coal even being in the text and talking about the problem. So this conference was set up as, we're going to name the problem up front and we're going to talk about what we do to solve it. So, you know, it's not exactly, you know, revolutionary thinking that if we're going to phase out fossil fuels, which is the purpose of this whole process, step one, stop approving new ones. And after 2 weeks away talking with government leaders, you know, these are pragmatic people about how do we phase out of it. I come back to Australia and we've approved new gas exploration onshore in New South Wales. We've approved new offshore exploration off Victoria. Only in the last few days, the South Australian Melanousis government is now talking about lifting the moratorium on fracking for gas in prime agricultural land. So it was like falling ass backwards through the looking glass, coming back to Australia of after being surrounded by governments, you know, whether it was from Colombia and the Netherlands, there was Austrian representatives, France were real leaders on this, coming back to a government which is wholly captured by the gas industry. And even the comments of the Prime Minister in the last 4 days of when asked about gas tax has just been, you know, spitting back to media. It's like, well, that's just a social media campaign being run by the Australia Institute. This is a movement of average Joes and punters across Australia just going, hang on. Big gas are taking the piss. We're approving new projects, which, you know, all the data is showing us that gas demand is going down domestically anyway, for basically exporters to make a mozzarella on, and we're not even getting a baseline tax back on revenue. So Australia is just, you know, looking backwards out of a train that's leaving the station and just kind of hankering after a vision. And then, you know, we can't forget that this is about export. This isn't about domestic gas. This is about appeasing Japan, appeasing our export companies who are multinationals.
I'd criticize the media as well because they haven't covered this conference. I've been covering it ever since I heard it was available, this conference, from the last BLEM conference. I thought, oh, that is going to hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what we need. And I've interviewed people since February about it. But mainly the media just seems to think, oh, well, China wasn't there, Russia wasn't there, and make these kind of comments. But who was there? And you were there. And that's why I want to talk to you. And I know there were pragmatic people there. It wasn't just idealists, talking through their hats. It was really people who urgently feel the problem and urgently feel the responsibility too. I think some of those global north people feel the responsibility, like the Netherlands, of, they've had huge profits in the past, and now there's some time to pull everyone along. So you met Susanna Muhammad, someone very unknown perhaps in Australia, but she was Colombia's environment minister. She's run a huge biodiversity conference in Cali a few years ago, and she's very, very terrific speaker, very good intellect. And she said the fossil fuel industry has robbed us of imagination. What did she mean?
You'll have to ask her what she means, but the bigger context for Ms. Mohammed's conversations. So I reported that back from after being in a room with her and a few other government representatives, including Ireland, Tuvalu, and some leading scientists, where she was really pointing to the fact that as people who are deeply embedded in the science and the politics, and having to constantly counter a fossil fuel industry who knows that its time is up, that we're in the final 10 to 15 years of business as we know it for them through combustion engines, of we are sitting in a crisis of ecology, climate, biodiversity, but also imagination. And that the fossil fuel industry, what are we, we're in 50, 60 years of it dominating how we think and how we do business, has robbed us of many things: clean water, breathable air, stable climate. But most importantly, at this time when we need to be building a new future, we're all seeing a lack of imagination of what does the world look like after fossil fuels. So that was really a clarion call to government leaders in the room at the conference and beyond of find your imagination and find your ability to both be leaders and be brave leaders and stand up to these fossil fuel companies who are, telling us that it's always going to be like this. We can't operate without them. We know that's bullshit. The human animal has survived for a very long time before we were sucking out dead dinosaurs from below the earth and burning them. And we are now at an inflection point and a turning where renewable energy is outpacing fossil fuels for both energy security, because you don't have to ship it everywhere. Cost, it's cheaper now to have solar panels on your roof than to be plugged into a central system. And also, just the ability for states to be sovereign in their energy and have security. Fossil fuels is a dinosaur in so many ways. We need to imagine the future that we want and get cracking on building it.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of the end of the Second World War, where the world got together and created the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and things like that. All these instruments that we now are seeing crumble, the commitment to them is kind of unsure. But that was out of a massive catastrophe, human catastrophe, which is called a major war. I feel we're forward looking into a major war, which is the climate chaos that the scientists you were with know and try to tell us, but nobody sort of really wants to hear. And use your imagination means, yes, think your brain up, put all your heads together. And that's what that conference was very bravely trying to do. But one of the streams at Santa Marta was parliamentarians for a fossil-free future. What did you learn from? I'd like to know about global South countries there, maybe our near neighbours. What were they saying? I think you said there were some hard questions asked there.
And this is about, what's next from the Santa Marta conference. And one of the outcomes of this conference was the follow-up will be held in Tuvalu in early 2027. So the Parliamentarians for a Fossil Fuel Future is a network that's been working together for quite some time now. We've got some Australian representatives on it too. But I was lucky enough to be admitted into the one-day workshop, which was led by the Netherlands government. And very ably led by Susan Kroger, who's a Dutch MP there, and of course the current Environment Minister for Colombia. And the Global South nations there ranged across Africa, Asia Pacific, and the Pacific nations throughout this whole conference, not just this session, were really strong in reinforcing the outcomes from the 2-day scientific panel and academic panel, which I was also at, saying that if action is not aligned to 1.5, what are we doing? Because, 1.5 to stay alive is not just a slogan. That is not just for the Pacific nations, but also for Australia. We are the driest continent on Earth. 1.5 and above for us is catastrophic, not just droughts, but this is just the future. And we're seeing ecological collapse already. It's not a future thing. It's happening now. And we are seeing fossil fuel wars. Iran is not some fight over a piece of water. That's a fossil fuel war. So the Pacific nations were very clear of coming from this, 1.5 is not a nice little nice to have, it's an essential. And yes, we are sitting at 1.5 and above, which then brings the action points to how do we draw down? And the science stream was very clear about false solutions do not occupy time, because if we keep buying into fossil fuel industry distractions such as carbon capture and storage, direct air drawdown, and all the others, we're not going to get there. This is about one, stopping any new approvals, a clear timed phase out for existing approvals. Stop subsidizing fossil fuels. I mean, really, a subsidy is an incentive. Maybe we need to change the word of stop incentivizing fossil fuels. And then, coming back to major petro states like Australia, use our tax and our other abilities for massive company exports to actually remove some of those incentives for them to keep making mega profits. So the coming up into Tuvalu early next year, it'll be co-hosted by the Irish and Tuvaluan governments. That's going to be the pattern going forward of a global north and a global south co-host it. It will be about bringing the outcomes from this first meeting together into some clear actionable points, and also, naming up some of the governments who should have been there, who are major contributors to climate change. And let's not let Australia off the hook on this one either. Not a single representative from our government turned up. We had a departmental rep turn up for the final 2 days, which was just the high level, people talking about what happened before and what they'll half agree to. Understanding Minister Bowen had a few things on and wasn't necessarily able to travel all that way, but we also have an assistant climate minister who could have been there. So Australia really needs to step up from now till the next conference in Tuvalu. And also remembering that Australia is currently co-host of the COP process, which this Santa Marta process is aiming to feed into to actually raise some ambition and just little things like, name up the problem, fossil fuels, name up the solutions, stop approving new ones, stop subsidizing, and get a clear timeline for a transition out. And where Australia is and positions itself in the coming year is going to be both telling and pivotal, because we are the petro state in the neighbourhood that's hosting the next conference, and we're the co-hosts of COP, well, the co-president, I should say, to be accurate.
My name's Darryl Best. I worked all my working career in coal mines. I am now passionate about a transition to renewables and about saving our planet. And you are listening to the Climate Action Radio Show on Community Radio. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
You are listening to Louise Morris from the Australia Institute talking to us on the Climate Action Show. Well, come to, back to subsidies. You said the conference was pragmatic and the transition is happening. So what do we do? Forget the false solutions, as you said. One action is around removing the 1.5 trillion globally, given as an incentive. You said incentive, it's probably a better word, an incentive to those companies to keep going. But how do we remove them without committing economic suicide and political suicide? We've seen the backlash from the fossil fuel industry here, and I think we're just always running scared. What's the step-by-step way to just start removing those subsidies?
I think first, and this comes back to Ms. Mohammed's comment of stop framing it as political or economic suicide and actually be pragmatic and call it what it is. Why is it economic suicide to stop handing money to a fossil fuel company? It's the exact opposite. It's a bog common sense thing. Gee, stop handing our money to some of the richest corporations in the world who are the problem. I'm pretty sure that Australians will be pretty happy that their tax dollars are not going to help incentivizing Woodside to, drill Scott Reef. Second one, I think we can see from the taxing gas conversation where now every time the PM or any other government rep turns up on media to talk about anything, the comments are just flooded with tax gas. The PM has started turning off his comment section to his social media because that's all everyone wants to talk about. So it would be the opposite of political suicide. It would be a damn smart move to let Australians know that, gee, the government is actually not the patsy of the fossil fuel industry. And keeping on home, because obviously we can't tell everyone else to stop subsidising or incentivising fossil fuels for trillions of dollars. Our analysis from March of this year shows that in the last year, Australia has increased our incentives to fossil fuel companies. So step one, stop it. Like, this is really, it is not complex. It's not hard. This is really basic shit. Stop approving new projects. Stop incentivizing. Stop handing taxpayer money over to fossil fuel companies to keep doing what they're doing and polluting and not paying any revenue on their exports. And also stop subsidizing new pipelines because the cap is always out. And I'm pretty damn sure there would have been some fossil fuel companies on budget night who attended that $5,000 a head event with the PM and others. It's really simple. This is not complex stuff, and it's not political suicide to do it. And as people who are involved in civil society, we need to reframe this, that the fossil fuel companies are not the boss. They are making a killing, and they've taught us to be completely and utterly, powerless in the face of their incredible might. Rubbish. We can change governments. Governments can change policy. And changing a policy is not a broken promise. It's making a smart decision based on evidence available. And we've got, what, 50, 60 years of evidence? Stop subsidizing, stop approving new ones, and let's get on with the phase out.
Oh, this is great hearing this. This is sort of bracing because I think this is the talk you heard at Santa Marta, like that bracing talk. And people can be real. Colombia was told you're committing economic suicide, and they just kept going. They stopped new contracts for coal, and I don't know oil, but they stopped new contracts. So they've tried to do it, and they need support of the world. Australia might remove subsidies. Okay, so we could do it, but what about global south countries like Nigeria that are locked into expanding their fossil fuel extraction to service their debt? And I know there were several streams at the conference, but it were about debt and the financial architecture. They kept talking about the global financial architecture. I know importers, for example, in the current oil crisis, are facing soaring food costs, and they can't afford fertilizers, and it's just hitting them really terribly. So, what ideas emerged at Santa Marta for that sort of situation? For system change rather than these incremental changes like stop subsidies and so on, system change. What were the ideas you heard?
Well, those points like stop subsidizing and stop approving will result in system change because the system will adjust when we stop incentivizing it and stop approving new ones. In terms of the finance stream, that was a very big conversation had by nations such as Nigeria and others who are locked into some truly freaking horrendous colonial structures of companies coming in, stripping what is some of the richest, most beautiful country on the planet of any ability to sustain itself and doing some, it's piracy what's going on there. So they were very clear naming up the problem. There's actually a the Niger Delta is going to be holding a conference in late July around some of the finance elements on this that Global North countries, which is why a Global North and a Global South co-host these processes, need to actually come in and address these financing and debt arrangements, which lock countries in to never-ending poverty and never-ending exploitation and colonialism. So, conference one, obviously no big solutions put forward. But again, this is not ridiculously complex stuff. And I'm always wary of people who pretend something's so complex because it's normally a distraction of, oh, it's too hard. You wouldn't possibly understand. Don't worry, your pretty head. Let us get on with, making a killing here. And in the case of Niger and others, it literally is a killing in many cases. That the countries who have profited off fossil fuels and the companies who have profited off fossil fuels need to be part of funding the transition out for those who have been really crippled by colonial fossil fuel processes. So, you know, name a company, name a country who's doing pretty well off it. They need to put aside some of their monster profits on this one. And this, again, always comes back to what is the taxation process? What is polluter pay levy opportunities? Decommissioning is massive. We have, both in Australia and many other countries, these rusting, leaking rigs of shame, both onshore and offshore, which are polluting, and companies have managed their arrangements very, very well, where they can basically cut and run. And we have that, you know, people imagine it as some developing world, you know, the oil fields of Nigeria mess. It's also happening off the coast of Victoria, where we've got Exxon, rebranded Esso after some rearranging, who are looking to just, you know, cut their old rigs off just below the bottom of the ocean where no one can see them and cut and run and leave them there polluting. So decommissioning and cleanup is a global problem that governments at a local level need to take the reins and lead on. So this is not, and we need to be very clear that Australia, by action here, will set an agenda that can be applied globally as well. So I want to be very clear that just, you know, positioning the big problem off to those other countries is a get out of jail free card for Australia. We need to put the pressure on here. This is a country that we have some sway on. It's a country with enormous wealth. We are very rich. Could be richer if we had a tax on the gas companies. I mean, we just clicked over of we've actually lost, as of early this week, $70 billion of revenue by the Albanese government not having a 25% export tax since they came into power. Imagine what we could do with $70 billion. NDIS would still be around, wouldn't it, in its old form? So we need to bring back the focus on what we can do, which is part of us taking the incentive to have the imagination for what's the world we need to create and get cracking on that. And, you know, the developing world, frankly, are working harder and smarter than Australians are on what that looks like. So get some revenue back into the coffers now, get cracking on our transition at home, and that will also help flow on to other nations of, look, one of the largest petro states in the world and the third largest exporter on gas on last details is getting on with it. We can do it too.
Yeah. Just tell us a bit more about the people you met and the sessions you attended that were inspiring for you.
I think the most inspiring for me was the academic and science conference, because these are people who are incredibly pragmatic, clear-eyed about the science, don't get distracted by, you know, political games such as, oh, we couldn't possibly, and oh my God, but it'll be economic suicide if we do this. And I'm like, well, actually, it's economic suicide right now if we keep burning fossil fuels. And it is 1.5 to stay alive. So any, you know, political games about, oh, but we'll just dump some carbon under the ocean is bullshit. It does not work. We know it doesn't work. If it's something has been, you know, 10 years off, the last 40 years off, and oh, it's still in trial phase, clearly it's not working. And stop giving money to the problem, which is what we're doing. So the two-day science and academia panel was wonderful. It also had a lot of people, including some Chinese academics, just going, look, here's the renewables. The transition's happening anyway. The renewable industry is its own best advocate. They're just getting on with the business of creating a new energy future. We need to call it for what it is. The age of fossil fuels is over, and they are just clawing in desperation to try and control governments and ways of thinking to make it last a little longer. And again, that comes back to, you know, it's in plain sight for us in Australia. We've got a PM who is now running cover for the fossil fuel industry, because the fossil fuel industry gets that their social license is sub-zero right now. So we now have a prime minister giving gas industry talking points. Oh, and a resource minister giving gas industry talking points. This is what it looks like when you've got a dying industry on the way out. So it was nice to be amongst people who can read the data and talk to it honestly, and also just say, right, this is the conference that kicks off the network who will just get on with the work of imagining that new future, creating it, and phasing out of fossil fuels.
Yeah, you said France was leading, and I think certainly Colombia is leading. I was most inspired by Gustavo Petro's final speech at the summit, his plenary. It was very philosophical and big picture. I love that. And I what, which countries had the brightest ideas? Like, where's that? It's got to be its energy. It seemed to be like very young energy. These people with beautiful, colourful clothes, lots of interviews with people. They just seem to be very bright-eyed. not this sort of heavy feeling you get when you see conferences being reported. It was very bright, it seems to me.
Well, that's also because, unlike a COP conference, there was no fossil fuel companies with stalls in the pavilions. COP has been co-opted by the fossil fuel companies. Back in, what was it, 2021? The Australian National Stall was co-branded with Santos, promoting member CCS. So you need to be very clear that this is a conference with a purpose, not a conference with a process that has been co-opted and, you know, allows fossil fuel. It's like having a quit smoking conference with big tobacco dominating the agenda at the COP. But why I say France were leading, and this is what we need to keep our eye on, is what are the actual commitments? You know, beyond lots and lots of rhetoric, what were the commitments? And France was the country that came forward with a clear timeline of when they will be out of various forms of fossil fuels out to 2050. So that's the sort of stuff we need to be looking for, of look past rhetoric, look past colour and movement. Who are the ones with a clear timeline on the table that they have committed to and will act on? And that's what we need Australia to do. You know, Australia's got a cracking history of getting some comsy, pretty, you know, ad campaign of look at us energizing the future. What it comes down to is sometimes the boring shit, but the boring shit is the important shit of what's our commitments, what are our timelines, and what's the structural things we are doing, such as no new approvals, stop incentivizing fossil fuels, give us a timeline of when this will be phased out. And that's why I say France was a leader, because they put that on the table.
Yeah. And speaking of timelines and roadmaps, I noticed Leeds University, one of the academics there, he presented a draft roadmap for Colombia, for example, which was spending billions now, but by 2040, they would be making money. You know, they'd be saving money. He, like, this was his outline. It was a draft. And I thought, that's something that our academics could be doing here. We could be helping countries. I don't think a country like East Timor is going to have the wherewithal to be, you know, planning roadmaps that are, you know, going to save them and not put immiserate their people in the process. I wondered if there was much of that, of reaching out.
Yeah, I think in the case of Timor, the global north has really transferred their view. We need to remember some of the very interesting political interactions Australia had with East Timor, incentivizing gas and some issues which ended up, you know, sending someone to prison for whistleblowing that one. So we need to be clear-eyed about what the geopolitics are behind this, and that companies like Australia, that was a Freudian slip, countries like Australia have actually been complicit in tying our near neighbours to really problematic fossil fuel projects. So I think we need to be not romantic about the Santa Marta process, because this was pragmatic people coming together to do pragmatic things, and also calling that power relationship between government and fossil fuel companies for what it is. Next step, going into Tuvalu. Tuvalu are very frank about the issues facing them and other nations like them, and also very frank about the role of petrostates like Australia in exacerbating the problems.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you, where do you think our efforts should be, not just for doing things in Australia, but for Australia to be doing things in the world, you know, making demands on Australia to be doing things for system change in the world? Where should our energies be going?
We've got, locally here in Australia, we've got a lot of ability to change bigger picture by putting pressure on our export gas industry, which is 80% of the gas we suck out of oceans is sent overseas, you know, and we've seen what happens when you try and diminish some of the monster profits gas companies make. They end up getting our PM to run out and do their frontline activism for them. So get into the ear of your federal MP, whatever flavour they are, because we've seen this is something from One Nation through to the ALP, Liberal people are having a very strange crack at it, through to the Greens, who've always been very strong on this. There's movement on gas exports, and the flow onto that is, you know, what we've been talking about, of once you start putting a decent tax and a fair tax on exports, we can start looking at how we use that money for other things, and also just taking away the incentive to let companies know that, you know, Norway will tax you 78% on the revenue, but geez, if you come to Australia, you can pretty much get it for free. Like, really, we're being taken for a ride. And really put pressure on decision makers, and I'm going to be broad to that state as well, that we won't wear any more approvals of fossil fuels. So that's offshore and onshore. And there's great incentives at local government levels, such as getting your town or region declared a fossil free, fuel free zone. So if you don't produce it, put that, wear it with pride. Say that, you know, whatever town you are is a fossil free zone for production, and we start building that from the grassroots up. And it's grassroots where the exciting stuff's happening. It's not in the halls of power and influence, which are heavily influenced by fossil fuels. So get into your grassroots stuff, get active, and be loud at your MP, because we've also heard back from many MPs that they've never in the history of all the time they've been engaged with politics seen a pushback from everyday Australians, not, you know, climate activists or anyone else, about this gas tax. So the worm is turning and we need to really keep going with it.
Fantastic. Well, on that note, I'll say goodbye to you, Louise. Thank you very much. It was wonderful that you could be there, and I'm very ashamed that Australia wasn't represented there. We've got Chris Bowen going to...
Oh, we had a departmental minister, to be clear and for accuracy. We had a departmental minister, not a member of parliament. That needs to be accurately represented. It was Dave Higgins.
Ah, yes.
You know, Australia, we're not particularly outward looking.
All right. Thank you very much, Louise. So that was Louise Morris from the Australia Institute.
Thank you. Bye.
The Climate Action Team would like to thank Only Just for their financial support of this program. Only Just sources high quality, fair trade goods and gifts from artisans in over 25 developing countries, showcasing partners that use traditional skills and modern designs to create beautiful goods through ethical and sustainable practices. Discover their unique range, onlyjust.com.au, or visit their Eltham store in the Eltham Village Shopping Centre on Main Road. It's Only Just.
Los que mueren por la vida no pueden llamarse muertos. Y a partir de este momento es prohibido llorarlos. Que se callen los redobles en todos los campanarios. Vamos, cumpa, carajo. Que para amanecer no hacen falta gallinas, sino cantar de gallos. Ellos no serán bandera para abrazarnos con ella. Y el que no la pueda alzar, que abandone la pelea. No es tiempo de recular, ni de vivir de leyenda. Canta, compañero, que tu voz sea disparo, que con las manos del pueblo no habrá canto desarmado. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, que no calle tu canción. Si te falta bastimento, tienes ese corazón que tiene latir de bombo, color de vino ancestral. Viene tu cueca de lucha cabalgando un viento austral. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero. Canta, canta, compañero, que tu voz sea disparo, que con las manos del pueblo no habrá canto desarmado. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, que no calle tu canción. Si te falta bastimento, tienes ese corazón que tiene latir de bombo, color de vino ancestral. Viene...
Viene tu cueca de lucha, jineteando un viento austral. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero. Los que mueren por la vida no pueden llamarse muertos. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero. Canta, canta, compañero, que no calle tu canción. Si te falta bastimento, tienes ese corazón. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, que no calle tu canción.
The Stockholm Environment Institute is an international non-profit that tackles climate challenges. They empower their partners with research tools and capacity building. Their largest funder is the government of Sweden, and they have 7 centres around the world. Emily Gosch is a senior scientist at SEI, and she's in charge of equitable transitions. So I think the first international conference on the transition away from fossil fuels at Santa Marta must have drawn her like a magnet. She's speaking to us now from New York. So welcome, Emily. Just to set the scene, tell us what it was like in Santa Marta.
It was actually really interesting atmosphere. I think that the realization that, you know, we actually need to transition away from fossil fuels, you know, was made very clear there. I think for many, many decades, just getting fossil fuels in the UNFCCC text to make that abundantly clear that we need to tackle fossil fuels took so long to talk about fossil fuel supply and what that transition means.
It's very daunting, but I think it must have been very liberating to be there among like-minded people. I saw a lot of the interviews on the YouTube. I managed to see some of the speeches. And it was so lively. And there were so many young people there, fresh voices. I hope you had a good experience. But let's talk about, you know, your area, roadmaps. Let's say these transition roadmaps. When you make a nationally determined contribution, that's like a sort of New Year's resolution, isn't it? But the roadmap is how you're going to do it, how you're going to whatever you've agreed to do. And most countries don't seem to have really written roadmaps, and I wonder if all these different roadmaps are coordinated in some way, because I think there's a hunger for a global roadmap. And people I interviewed before the conference said, well, don't expect a roadmap out of this conference, and I understand that this is a big work in progress. But countries like France announced that they're having a roadmap, but they actually don't use a lot of fossil fuels. 1% of their electricity is coal. So, you know, that's easy to say they'll phase that out, but many countries are locked in by debt to increasing their mining or exploitation and export and consumption. So what can you do for them? What restructuring and support is needed for them?
I think one aspect of the conference was obviously this recognition that roadmaps are needed. But I think national roadmaps are one step. And I think countries are interconnected with each other. You can't just have, you know, national roadmap here, national roadmap there without recognizing the trade implications of that and how countries are deeply connected to each other. And that is something that is often missed in this national roadmaps, is that we have to move together as a global, entity towards, because if one country phases out fossil fuels, another, phases out production, another country might step in. So, you know, we have to look at these and move away from fossil fuels together in order to meet our climate goals. And then the other aspect about roadmaps was that, you know, you have the very technical discussions around what decarbonization means, what technologies, but then you also have a lot around what does an equitable transition mean? How do you consider the jobs lost, the livelihoods that the communities where you have to transform their livelihoods because they're very dependent on fossil fuels? What does economic diversification mean? So there's many of these different conversations happening, and what I'm really looking forward to in the future is how to integrate these different conversations in order to come up with a very integrated roadmap that considers both the technological components as well as the justice components, as well as the investment and financial. Like, we're having all these different discussions, but how do you bring it all together into one to develop these national roadmaps, these global roadmaps? That's really what came to the forefront, that we have a lot more discussing and a lot of integrating to do in these upcoming months and years. Yeah.
And did you find the format of Santa Marta helpful, liberating to those kind of discussions?
I think it was a great start. I think we made a lot of realizations of what we need to do next. And hopefully in the next conference, a lot of the lessons learned will come through. Like,
can you give me an example of something that the Stockholm Institute does in partnering with a country, especially a country in the global south that might be locked into debt and can't make this transition, can't even make a plan for a transition? How would you support them?
You can't really dictate anything. It's hard to also predict what the future is going to look like these days. It's one thing that we know for sure is we need to reduce our emissions. We need to reduce it rapidly in order to stay within 1.5, or at least reduce the overshoot that's as we're currently potentially surpass that but mark.
We've known that for 30 years, and this particular conference seems to be like a breakthrough. Like, I would have thought you'd hear examples. So were there any models you heard of other regions or countries, or especially fossil fuel affected regions that are taking another path, diversifying, for example? Did you hear something like that?
I mean, Colombia has taken enormous steps to recognize that an alternative future is needed. And I think they were obviously at the forefront of a lot of the discussions as they hosted the conference, but they themselves have made that recognition, not only that a fossil fuel phase out is needed, but that it needs to be done in an equitable way. And we have colleagues within SEI, we have a Latin America office based in Bogota, Colombia, that are working closely with communities that are both fossil fuel dependent communities, like coal within coal mining regions, and working with them to understand what a labor transition looks like. What does, and in particular, how does it affect, the most vulnerable populations, females and just looking at it from a gender aspect. They're also looking at what does, the transition itself has some, it could have impacts. Like, what does responsible renewable energy development mean? So they're working with indigenous communities within Colombia and other marginalized groups to also make sure that they're on board with renewable development that happens, and that they're involved in that. So I think SEI is really part of that process, and we can see, we're supporting countries like Colombia that are already very forward looking in the way that they'd like to transition, and are coming up with roadmaps and spending. They put in $40 billion investment towards just energy transition, which is very notable.
Yes. And I noticed that Leeds University did a draft roadmap for Colombia, and they scoped out what would be required. And it was a huge investment in the next 10 or 20 years. But by 2040, Colombia will be out of the debt, out of the, they'll have a diversified economy, and they'll be doing well, it's to be a healthy, balanced sort of life. And I think that's something they're very aware of in Colombia, because they've got the Amazon region there. Brazil is aware of that too. That huge biodiversity, it's their thing to protect. They must protect it. And like, Australia has that too. Every country has biodiversity that they need to protect. But we have a model of business and economy that seems to trash that quite easily. President Petro said, I thought he was quite a visionary person, and I quote him to Australian people, and they think it's melodramatic. But I think it's wonderful that he said the world is threatened by a suicidal model of capitalism leading to war, fascism, and the potential extinction of humanity. And I think we certainly need a reset in favor of the earth, in favor of, yeah, you say women, children, life. You know, you can't live in an increasingly polluted, climatically chaotic world. And I wondered what you think, something specific, because listeners can't kind of get it if it's abstract. What are the essential building steps to that, those transitions that you've worked on and that you've seen other people working on? What are the essential building steps of that?
I think that our current economic model has brought this type of highly polluting system that ultimately I don't see us having a successful transition without tackling our underlying economic system that's really dependent on continued economic growth. And I think we definitely need to shift to focusing on well-being, what that means, what that looks like. We have to not just look at a country's, like I mentioned, as an individual, but we are part of a system, especially when you look at the global north and global south and how global north countries just continue to be dependent on resources from the global south and in ways, like you mentioned, debt and how that system is designed to continue to extract resources that are often leaving many countries in a worse off state in some cases. And so we need to look at the system as a whole. I think that the transition is not just a transition to renewables. And I think that's often what we discuss, but we have to look at how we consume and again, where those materials come from, how we use up our resources. And that's a lot of the work that we've been doing, for example, on carbon inequality, looking at how the emissions of the top 10% are almost half of global emissions come from the richest top 10%. Whereas how did we get here? What are the systems that got us here? And having that systems kind of thinking is incredibly important. And so I hope that more of that will bubble up. And I think we are recognizing that more, but what that means in terms of the solutions, I think is we're not entirely there in really understanding what that alternative future could look like and what that alternative economic system looks like, yeah. Even though.
Well, this whole conference was in the context of shocking world events. I mean, at the beginning of the year, Venezuela was attacked and invaded. And then Iran, like the world is, shockwaves are going through, not so much in the rich countries, that those top 10% are not feeling the shockwaves, but further down where the food is affected. You must know that about the countries you work with already. These, you know, fertilizers can't get through, people can't plant their crops. You know, the historic context in which this conference, were people alive to that when they were there?
It was interesting having this conference at a time where oil prices are rising, and the immediate response is obviously we need to provide tax breaks or subsidized fuels, and which is important for, you know, the most vulnerable populations that are obviously most that are dependent and need, that don't have the ability to deal with these shocks. But then it's all at the same time, it makes us very aware of how much our society still depends on fossil fuels and how much we talk about energy security and link that to fossil fuels, but not necessarily alternative forms of energy. And so on one hand, that really became, how do we demonstrate that energy security can be achieved through clean energy sources and looking at and how we use energy and things like that. So I think that was definitely a discussion that came in frequently throughout the conference. So,
What did the conference demonstrate to you? What was the highlight?
It was just really nice to be in a space that we were talking about fossil fuels just directly, and I think the fact that it was the purpose of it was to have the coalition of the willing. So these are people that are countries that are actually also agree with that sentiment. And so I think just on a whole, there was a lot of hope that, okay, we're building towards an actual transition. We're coming up with the roadmap that we're, yeah. we're the ingredients, we're coming up with that ingredient so that hopefully we can see this in the future. So I think there is a lot of hope. I think that still there's a lot of work to do. That also became clear that we urgently need to do a lot of work in the next 5 to 10 years. And so it's a bit daunting too. So that also became very clear.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Emily. It's late at night for you. And I appreciate you talking to us. And I hope your work with the Stockholm Environment Institute goes well and that we hear more from you as it goes on. Because as you say, there's a lot to do, but it's better than just pushing it down the road and pushing it down the road for the next generation, because that's fatalistic. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We've been talking to Emily Gosch from the Stockholm Environment Institute.
Canta, canta, compañero, que tu voz sea disparo, que con las manos del pueblo no habrá canto desarmado. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, que no calle tu canción. Si te falta bastimento, tienes ese corazón.
When you compare an old growth forest compared to a forest which is regrowing after a disturbance like logging, they're actually quite different ecosystems. Generally, like older, wetter forests slow down the path of fire, and this is actually quite a well-known phenomenon. Historically, these big, large fires have been quite rare, but what we've seen in the last 20 years is they're becoming quite a lot more common. So we've had 3 in the last 20 years. This is definitely because of climate change, which is making our ecosystems a lot drier and the fire weather more intense.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
Thank you, dear listeners, for paying attention to this very intense sort of exploration of the Santa Marta Conference. It's now my 6th program on the Santa Marta Conference, and there's still many more people I want to interview who were there and who are going to take it on to Tuvalu in next year. Thank you, dear listeners, for hanging in there and listening to this, what is a quite detailed exploration of the Santa Marta Conference. I've done now 5 programs. I think this is the 6th program on Santa Marta because I think it's such an historic event. And I have many more people I want to interview. So I'm hoping that you find it as interesting as I do to see all these points of view. Our guests tonight were Louise Morris from the Australia Institute and Emily Gosch from the Stockholm Environment Institute. The song was by Ali Primera. My name is Vivian Langford. Goodbye and good luck.
This is coal. Don't be afraid.
The
Don't
treasurer.
Be scared. It's coal. It's coal. It's coal.
Tune in every Monday at 5 p.m. to hear the Climate Action Radio Show.
People are where they are. You're going to have to meet them where they are. And you're going to have to be generous. And that's why it comes back to the idea of friendship. Friendship is never with people who are just like you. What a boring world it would be if you only made friends with people identical to yourself. You know, then again, you might as well have imaginary friends. You want to learn from people. You want to laugh with them. You want to laugh at their limitations. They laugh at your limitations. You grow together. Yeah? So politics is also like that. If you're just stagnant, you know, if somebody enters politics age 15 and when they are 35, the same person, terrible. They haven't grown, they haven't shaped themselves. I'm Vijay Prashad with 3CR. You better listen to it because it's really good.